You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, recent research shows there are fewer people fishing in Wisconsin in recent years. We'll find out why that is and who's actually doing more fishing these days. First, if you've ever tried to have a conversation in the comment section on Facebook, you know it can go downhill real fast. But our guest says there's one place on Facebook where conversation, community, and sharing is thriving, and that's Facebook groups. There are Facebook groups for lots of different purposes, hobby or interest-based, support groups, location-based. Here's a few Wisconsin groups. There are Women Hiking Wisconsin, Abandoned Wisconsin, Wisconsin Rut Report, Wisconsin Cat Enthusiast Group. You get the picture. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a member in some of these groups, maybe private groups on Facebook? If so, why? Do you comment and interact, or you just enjoy reading? Do you find it a more positive experience than most of the internet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ann Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She wrote the piece, "These Women Are Only on Facebook for the Groups." Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into the groups, part of the reason behind your story is what's going on the rest of social media. It can be pretty ugly, right? Especially for women participating in the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of women experience social media as a place of toxicity, of, arguing or targeting or being afraid of, saying the wrong thing or of other people saying things that you find offensive or racist or sexist, that sort of thing.
Now, talk about these Facebook groups for people who haven't used them, whether they're Facebook users or not. What are they? How do they work?
Yeah, so they're actually, not that old, like only really in the last 4 or 5 years. And there's a number of different types of groups. So you can have totally open, like anyone can find, anyone can join. You can have ones that like you can search for it and then ask to join. That's oftentimes called a private group. And then you can have totally secret ones and they can be any size. So there are groups out there that are millions of people large. Like there's one called Dog Spotting that's all about posting dogs that you've seen kind of in the wild. There's like very specific rules. Like it can't be a dog that you've ever seen before. It has to be a stranger to you. And then there are groups that are just like 4 or 5 people and function, similarly to something like a group text or an email chain, where it's really just people who know each other well and are sharing information and links and comments and support.
And this is basically a completely reverse idea from what social media has been in the past. Like Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, used to say in the past, hey, privacy is over. This is this great world where we're all sharing with everybody. And now more recently he said, hey, private conversations, that's the wave of the future. This is a different approach, right?
Yeah, I think he recognized, well, a lot of things. I think he recognized some of the ways that Facebook was being manipulated for harm, but also he realized that people were engaging with Facebook not in the way that maybe he had previously imagined, which was like you press home and then you scroll through your newsfeed. It was more that people were going directly to these groups and that's where they were spending time or commenting or liking. And so now the algorithm has actually shifted a bit. So if you are part of these groups and you log on to Facebook, people tell me that they find that like their feed is almost entirely their group. So it dominates the feed now.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Amanda is with us in Stevens Point. Amanda, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. Are you in a group?
I belong to several private groups that are geared towards stepmoms.
And what kind of rules do they have? A big part of Anne's story is how they maintain decent civil behavior amongst group members. What kind of things are there, Amanda?
Well, the moderators, they definitely stay on top of the group discussions. One of them has a rule where you can't, no ranting. You have to be there to ask advice. There is quite frequently, when you're talking about family dynamics, of course, discussions can get rather heated and there are quite a few times where discussions, like the comments will get turned off or, and posts will just be entirely deleted and they the moderators say, well, we will talk to them personally. So.
And Amanda, I want to ask before we let you go, do you feel like you've gotten good advice either by asking questions or reading other people's questions and answers?
I definitely feel I have. I've connected with several other stepmoms and been able to, being in a blended family, it can, there's things like family law that you just have to, you have to educate yourself on. And I feel like, you know, as a group, we are able to do that.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing that. And that illustrates some of the points you bring up in how these things are run and controlled. Some of them have rules about avoiding hostility or arguments or judgment. Can you talk about some of the things you've seen?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the caller's example is a really great example of how these things are valuable, because oftentimes you might not know a ton of other stepmoms, right? You want a lot of specific advice about the ins and outs of being a stepmom, both, you know, in terms of emotion, psychology, legal stuff, all sorts of things. And, you know, I think that sometimes if we do ask people that we are close with or know in person, there's some extra emotional baggage that becomes part of that conversation. Whereas these people are effectively strangers, you might become close to them through a group, but they can give you advice that is outside of that other part of your relationship. And I think people really appreciate that.
Thanks for that call, Amanda. We're talking to Ann Helen Peterson from BuzzFeed News, talking about Facebook groups. Many people see them as a positive alternative to the nastiness you could find elsewhere on Facebook or all over the internet. Back to your calls now. Carolyn is with us in Lancaster. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to say that I have had a super positive experience in Facebook groups. I'm actually in not just like a Facebook group for a webcomic I like, but I'm in a whole series of groups for people who like this webcomic, Akewood, and that has subdivisions for talking about recipes we like, even a specific Instant Pot group, or talking about our cats, or craft projects we're working on, all sorts of things just for people who like this webcomic.
Wow. And Carolyn, have you been in comic-related comment groups elsewhere online, outside of these controlled groups? And if so, what have you seen there?
This is really the only one I'm in. This is really the only one I like.
Gotcha.
But it is really environment, and one of the more interesting aspects of it.
Your line broke up a little there, Carolyn, and I want to bring Ann back in on that. A positive environment for a woman, a community built around comics, that might sound almost utopian for people who have experienced some web conversations about comics or other issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially on places like Twitter, there is just an animosity and a vitriol and a real misogyny that's directed towards women who enter into these traditionally male fan spaces. And the combination of having moderators in these groups and also just having people who want to make it into a positive space, that it allows the groups to thrive. And I love the caller pointed out all the subgroups. This is something that happens a lot, is you'll have a main group that is around an idea, whether it's like dogs or a podcast. Podcasts actually have huge, huge Facebook groups. And then they subdivide according to interest or identity. And you can be in a ton of these groups. So you could be in one for single moms, but you could also be in one for Instant Pot recipes.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I have started a group on Facebook called Perspective. And I started it probably about 2 years ago, in hopes of learning more about how people think differently. And I wish it would go a little bit better, because there's not a lot of commenting going on yet, but it's very interesting to just try and have conversations instead of just people getting mad at each other. If you see, you know, a news story or something, and then, you know, people just while they're whoever's posting it, you can kind of see which way they are thinking. So I try and do a variety, so it's not just my way of thinking, to try and get people talking.
Kylie, thank you so much. Good luck as you work on that and hopefully get more people participating there. So that's pretty ambitious, Anne.
Yeah, you know, I think the hard thing right now with our political environment is that if you are trying to start conversations that are explicitly trying to start conversation, right, that oftentimes people are like, I don't want to go there, right? It's like when someone posts on their own Facebook profile, like, let's talk about the different sides, or let's talk about our president, or let's talk about the Democratic primary. Whereas the magical thing that I've seen about groups is that you do end up having these really intense and thoughtful conversations that do touch on the more fraught political and cultural issues. It's just that the conversations get started around this other item or identity or common, you know, appreciation. And so you get into these very intimate conversations, but you have to, you know, you have a different place of access instead of just being like, let's talk about politics.
And in just our last minute or so, Facebook kind of stumbled onto this. Are you worried that they will ruin it in the future?
Well, I think people are already worried about that just in terms of like, you know, what kind of information that they are gleaning from us. Like, even though you are on Facebook and you consider it a private or a secret group, like Facebook already knows all of that information. And I think a lot of people are frustrated, too, that Facebook is one of the few places where you can form these communities at this moment. The other thing that is worth mentioning and considering is that some Facebook groups can become echo chambers where misinformation, whether it's about, you know, flat earth society or vaccines, can also be propagated. So it's not always just a positive thing.
Anne, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Anne Helen Peterson, senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She wrote the piece we've been talking about, These Women Are Only on Facebook for the Groups. Still time for you to share your experiences if you've participated in, or as Kylie did, created your own Facebook group. What kind of group? How is it moderated? Did it work at keeping a civil, lively conversation without some of the nastiness you can see on the internet sometime? You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, fishing is down in Wisconsin, except among women. We'll look at new research on fishing here in the state, how it's been changing over the years, and how it affects conservation efforts. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Attorney General William Barr testified in front of Congress today about his handling of the Mueller report. We'll find out more during our look at the week in Washington. First, when was the last time you went fishing? If you're having a hard time remembering, you're probably not alone. Recent research from Michigan Technological University shows the overall number of people fishing in Wisconsin has been declining over the last few decades. But in a new piece for wiscontext.org, our guest says that's not the whole story, with women doing more fishing over time. Erin Burkett is a PhD candidate in the Department of Environmental and Energy Policy at Michigan Tech University. She's also the author of a new essay about fishing trends in Wisconsin. Erin, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, big picture, what do you see when you look at the trends in the number of people fishing here in Wisconsin?
Well, what we're seeing is that really overall fishing participation rates have declined over this 17-year period that we looked at from 2000 to 2016. And we also saw that the total number of fishing licenses sold dropped. But something interesting about that drop was that it was offset a bit by increases in women's fishing participation.
Right. So over time, I mean, traditionally, I think people would assume that more men are fishing than women. From your numbers, it looks like that's true. But the number of men, if I have this right, it's going down. The number of women, it's been going up.
Yep, that's right.
So before we get into dig deeper into those numbers, this is important to non-fisher folk, too, right? Because the licenses, the fees people pay have a lot to do with how we conserve our water in Wisconsin.
Right, absolutely. So fishing license sales, just like hunting licenses, they provide direct financial support for the DNR and its fisheries management efforts, things like habitat, restoration, you know, fisheries stocking, running hatcheries. There's a lot of things that that money goes into.
When we look at this overall decline, we'll talk about women in a little bit in particular, but when we look at the overall decline and the declining number of men fishing, what are some of the ideas about why those numbers are going down?
Well, there's a few ideas. So number one, there's simply a lot more activities that fill our day now than there were, say, 50 years ago. And so there's just a lot more competing for people's time. And in terms of outdoors recreation specifically, there's a lot of options, and fishing might not be the only way people are choosing to get outdoors. You can think about things like stand-up paddleboarding or paddling sports. And then there's also some evidence out there that societal attitudes more broadly towards wildlife are kind of shifting. So this may not be true for everyone, but some people may be more comfortable with activities like bird watching or just simply getting out and for a hike and seeing wildlife versus going out to fish or hunt.
What kind of things do we see when we look at different generations and their participation or not in fishing?
Yeah, so we've definitely found that people who are members of the baby boomer generation, especially the older baby boomers born between, say, 1955 and 1967, they tend to fish more than other generations. And one exception we did find is that among women, younger women born after 1985 are fishing more than, say, women born in the 1970s. But really, it's like the core group, and this has been shown in hunting as well, as these baby boomers.
Let's look at the lifestyle of those who do fish. You, in your writing on this, you find that we kind of go, for someone who does fish, they go up and down over their lives very often. What kind of shape does that take?
Well, some people can participate, you know, they might start fishing as a kid, but then imagine, you know, things, different stages of life take over. So often we see a drop in participation at college ages because young people simply don't have as much time. Or for women, for example, when they're starting families, having kids, some, you know, may take their families fishing, but at first, you know, it might be a little bit much. They're participating in other activities that might be more easily accessible once you're starting a family. And then at older stages, you know, as people get older, you might have less physical capabilities to get around. So, you know, you might kind of stop fishing after a while. That's certainly not true for everyone. There's still dedicated older anglers out there.
We're talking to Erin Burkett from Michigan Tech University. She has a new report on about fishing in Wisconsin. You can find that at wiscontext.org. Erin, is there a concern that there could be a snowball effect if, you know, one generation fishes less than the previous one? Well, then they're less likely to bring up their kids to have that interest in going out and hitting the lake or river. And this could really keep going down over time.
Yeah, there's some worry about that for sure. A great example is, you know, if you don't have somebody in your life, an older mentor or relative, somebody you look up to that's showing you those experiences, that may be one way you're missing out on being recruited into a sport like fishing. Luckily, the declines we're seeing in terms of fishing participation, they're really not nearly as dramatic as declines in hunting participation, for example. And you can, there's probably other reasons for that too. You know, fishing in general is a bit more accessible to folks. You don't need, you know, training, comfort level with a gun, anything like that. So I think that's probably tying into why fishing participation, although we're seeing declines overall, you know, more women are coming along and fishing.
Erin, have you seen efforts to recruit the next generation of people to go fishing?
Yeah, this is really big right now. So some of the work that I do looks at women-specific recruitment programs. So you may have heard the term R3 floating around. So R3 stands for recruitment, retention, and reactivation. And this is really, you know, state and national kind of movement for these programs that show people, really teach them how to get into fishing or hunting and help them become lifelong participants. So the recruitment is really that education stage, like, you know, hosting activities where people can try it out. And then the retention part of that is really, how do you keep them coming back year after year? So what is it going to take to, you know, build these lifelong participants? And then reactivation is really exactly like it sounds. So somebody who maybe fished in the past or for one reason or another hasn't been getting out there recently, how do you, you know, bring them back into the sport?
And then we had talked earlier, Aaron, about how conservation programs can rely on those fishing licenses. Are we seeing, say, state authorities starting to rethink how they do that kind of funding if they can't count on those fishing license numbers to stay up?
Yeah, I can't remember offhand which state it is, but there's definitely conversations about this. And one state I know is maybe even try to, you know, say instead of a fishing license, something like a bird watching or a wildlife photography hiking license. So traditionally, obviously, we've got anglers and hunters have been providing these conservation funds for years and years. If they're, you know, simply not participating at the same rates, there are questions about, well, is this funding scheme kind of, is it sustainable? Who else can we ask, you know, to support conservation in other ways?
And I want to ask on a personal note, Aaron, I'm one of those people who went fishing with my grandparents as a kid. I haven't picked it up as a grown up. Where do you fit into this? You research fishing. Do you go fishing yourself nowadays?
I do. I am one of those, I guess, occasional. So I guess for me, maybe I need to reactivate every once in a while. But I did go ice fishing this past winter. It was really fun. And for me, it is a life circumstance thing. You know, when I've gotten busier, gone off to school, sometimes other activities take precedent. But yeah, same. I grew up with a family that hunted and fished. And I think that definitely is instilled in me. And I always kind of have it on my mind that I'd like to get back to it.
Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
Yeah, no problem. It was great.
That was Aaron Burkett, PhD candidate in the Department of Environmental and Energy Policy at Michigan Tech University. She was with us today to talk about what's behind a decline in the number of people fishing overall in Wisconsin, while the number of women fishing is going up. You can find her essay about that online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Democratic leadership and the president say they're ready to pursue a $2 trillion investment in infrastructure. We'll find out how the rest of Congress is feeling about the idea. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The state Supreme Court says the appointees chosen by former Governor Walker last December can return to work, for now at least. We'll get an update on the ongoing court saga coming up. First, we take our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Attorney General William Barr testified about his handling of the Mueller report in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today. President Trump is suing two banks to block the release of his financial records. And the president and Democratic leaders say they're willing to work together in shaping a $2 trillion infrastructure package. Our question for you this week, are you happy to hear the president and Congress talking about infrastructure? Where do you want to see the focus go as an infrastructure plan takes shape? Building new roads? Fixing the ones you already have? How are we going to pay for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back with you.
Well, we know that after Attorney General Barr released his four-page statement on the Russia probe, Special Counsel Robert Mueller wrote Barr saying he was disappointed in the summary. Barr called Mueller on the phone. Here he is today describing that conversation.
And I asked him if he was suggesting that the March 24th letter was inaccurate. And he said no, but that the press reporting had been inaccurate and that the press was reading too much into it. And I asked him, you know, specifically what his concern was. And he said that his concern focused on his explanation of why he did not reach a conclusion on obstruction.
And Scott, this letter, which is out now from Robert Mueller or his team, that got a lot of attention today, right?
That's right. The letter from Robert Mueller to Bill Barr was really at the crux of this hearing today before the Senate Judiciary. You know, we can go to Robert Mueller's own words because we now have this two-page letter from Robert Mueller. He says in the letter that Bill Barr's summary from March did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of Robert Mueller's work and conclusions, specifically having to do with his analysis of whether President Trump committed obstruction of justice. And so, you know, you have these two different characteristics of the conversation between Robert Mueller and Bill Barr, but we really can go to Robert Mueller's own words in this letter, and I think that's what Democrats were really keying in on. Of course, Democrats, you know, they are now calling for Bill Barr to resign. They say that he has misled the American public. He has misled the Congress in terms of trying to cover for the president in regards to the Mueller report. And so these are serious allegations. And it was a pretty combative 4-hour grilling that we saw today on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, we heard the attorney general refer to that letter as snitty, I think was the word he used, and he speculated that it might have been written not by Robert Mueller, but by a staffer. Are people on Senate Judiciary or other congressional committees trying to get Robert Mueller himself to come forward and testify?
Well, certainly Democrats would love to hear from Bob Mueller to sort of clear up some of this confusion. But the Senate Judiciary Chairman, Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, a close ally of the president, has said this investigation is over. He has heard enough. He heard enough from Bill Barr today. And as far as he's concerned, the committee does not need to look into this matter any further. Now, on the other side of the Capitol, tomorrow, House Democrats, the House Judiciary Committee is supposed to have Attorney General Bill Barr before them to testify before the House. Right now, it is unclear. There's a dispute over sort of the parameters of the questioning, whether staff members would be allowed to question the Attorney General, which is somewhat rare. And so they are quarreling over that fact. And we're not sure at this very moment whether the Attorney General will come before the Democratic-led committee in the House.
So a big overall concern is the question of whether Attorney General Barr misled and I guess deliberately misled Congress and the public in that 4-page memo versus what's actually in the Mueller report. Is that a fair assessment of what has people, Democrats in particular, concerned?
Right. I mean, Democrats, including most of the 2020 presidential field, Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, some of those folks who were among the questioners today in the Senate Judiciary Committee, they really feel that Bill Barr has mischaracterized the Mueller report, not only at his press conference, but also in testimony before the committee. And so that is really why senators and especially Democrats want to hear from Robert Mueller himself, so they can hear in his own words exactly, you know, why he made certain conclusions and what he found in the investigation specifically related to obstruction of justice.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics. Another big story with a big price tag, Scott. Democratic leaders met with the president yesterday to talk about infrastructure. They came out with a tentative agreement on the basics. Here's a listen to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer after that meeting.
We agreed on a number, which was very, very good, $2 trillion for infrastructure. Originally, we had started a little lower. Even the president was eager to push it up to $2 trillion.
So infrastructure, ever since President Trump came into office and since Democrats took over in the House now, people have pointed to that as an issue that there could be bipartisan cooperation on. Is this plan that, or is this so vague that we just can't tell what's coming out of it yet?
Well, it was a bit of a surprise that they did come to an agreement on that specific number, $2 trillion. A lot of Republicans had wanted a smaller number, not so much federal spending. Democrats have been trying to push that number higher. $2 trillion is in the range that Nancy Pelosi has laid out in the past. And so that was quite a bit of a surprise, especially as we get more and more into this 2020 election season where people don't see much hope for legislating. So, but of course, the devil is in the details. That's what we heard over and over from both Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, who say, how will the Congress, how will Washington pay for this $2 trillion plan? So Trump and the Democratic leaders will be meeting again in 3 weeks. What Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have said to the president is, we want you to lead on this issue. Now that we've agreed on a number, we want you to come up for the pay-fors. And that is really going to be the challenge at this point is, you know, how do you come up with that money without going into more debt?
Now, that $2 trillion, is that, do we know the time frame of that? Is that $2 trillion in 2 years or $2 trillion in 20 years? The math comes out real different depending on the answer to that.
Yeah, it's $2 trillion over 10 years. At least that's sort of the parameters of this discussion now. So one of the possibilities that the president actually supports, not so popular in his own party, but he supports raising or doubling the federal gas tax, which has not been raised since Bill Clinton was president. And so that is causing a little bit of heartburn in the Republican Party. There are some Democrats who are for raising the gas tax. Of course, that doesn't get you to $2 trillion. So I think it's really going to have to be a combination of a lot of different things in order to get to that number.
What have we heard since that meeting from key, especially Senate Republicans on this?
Senate Republicans are not so hot on tackling infrastructure. I think they agree on the idea that our roads and our bridges are aging and dilapidated and need repairs. But there is not the appetite, especially from the Republicans who control the upper chamber. There's not the appetite to spend. Of course, the Democratic approach would be to add taxes in order to pay for new and aging infrastructure. And so right now, in the middle of an election season, especially in these sort of times and these politics, the Republican Party is not too keen on boosting taxes.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about some of the big stories in national politics this week. We heard from Carl in Wisconsin Dells, who says, I build highways. I'm driving my dump truck right now. I'm glad to hear some talk about roads, which we actually need, instead of a wall. Well, how about you? What do you think about this talk about a big boost, a $2 trillion national boost in infrastructure spending on things like building new roads, maintaining old roads, bridges, ports are in the mix. I'm assuming rail, too. What do you think about this idea? Do we need this big investment? What should be the focus? If so, how do we pay for it? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you want to hear presidential candidates talking about it? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Scott, we've got this presidential campaign going on. Former Vice President Joe Biden is now in it. And you wrote a piece about how he and other Democratic candidates are trying to appeal to African-American voters looking ahead to primary season. What are you seeing out there?
Well, exactly. Vice President Biden has been reaching out to congressional Black Caucus members on Capitol Hill, trying to win their endorsements. Of course, the challenge is that they also have some loyalties to their fellow CBC members, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, who frequently show up to their meetings, two prominent African-American candidates and senators. And so the reason why I think there's this focus on the African-American vote is because the third major state in the primary contest is South Carolina, which in the Democratic Party is comprised of mainly African-Americans. And then a lot of the primary calendar turns to the South, places like Alabama and Mississippi and Texas, where there is a substantial African-American population in some of these places. And so we frequently hear a lot of time and focus and attention spent on Iowa and New Hampshire, but once those primaries and caucuses are wrapped up, the attention really does shift to the South.
Now, Biden and other Democratic candidates are looking to lock up key endorsements, as you mentioned. Are we seeing a lot of people looking to endorse this soon, given that we're closing in on 24 candidates? Who knows how many there will be by Election Day, by the time the campaign starts for real?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you're seeing a lot of, I think the approach from a lot of these lawmakers is, you either want to be the opening pitcher, the starting pitcher, or the closer. And so people jump in early. sort of betting on a horse early. We saw that with the former CBC chairman, Cedric Richmond of Louisiana, who I spoke to for my piece. He endorsed Biden early. He's been one of the folks trying to lure Biden and get him into the race, which he was successful in doing. And other folks, I think, wait until the nomination contest is well on its way, the primary contest, when candidates start to drop out and there's a clearer idea of who is going to be the nominee, like we saw in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. And so I think there's those two approaches. And right now we are seeing sort of the first wave of lawmakers and other politicians endorsing presidential candidates.
Are other candidates actively competing with Joe Biden for these votes, these African-American votes in places like South Carolina and some of those southern Super Tuesday states?
We have not seen too many endorsements. They are. I mean, the candidates are spending a significant amount of time in places like South Carolina. I think all of the major presidential candidates, even folks like Bernie Sanders, who's from Vermont, is spending time in South Carolina, just because you realize how valuable how electoral rich some of those states are in terms of the primary. And so you have to put in the time, you have to form the relationships with the local politicians on the ground in those places and get your own volunteers and campaigns on the ground in places like South Carolina. And so you are seeing that. Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, has spent time in South Carolina, in other parts of the South. And so I think anyone who has a real campaign strategy is going to be targeting those states and trying to reach out to African-American voters.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics over the course of this week. Let's turn to these lawsuits now, Scott, from President Trump and family members targeting Deutsche Bank and Capital One, their goal to prevent them from releasing personal financial documents. And that's to counter Democrats in Congress who want those personal financial documents. What kind of stuff are we talking about here? What kind of stuff is at stake?
Well, I think the real vulnerability for the president and his family when it comes to the financial documents is there's been some reporting uncovering the fact that the president and some of his business entities may have fudged some of their numbers in terms of getting financial loans in the past. This would have been before he was president. And so House Democrats, who are investigating every aspect of the president's life and business dealings, they want to get a hold of those business documents, financial documents, bank statements, and find out if that is in fact true. Did the president, which a lot of those allegations would be illegal if you misrepresented yourself, misrepresented your earnings, or misrepresented your financial statements to a bank, that would be illegal and violate federal law. And so Democrats want to get their hands on that. The president and his family have essentially sued the Democrats to prevent them, sort of taking a more proactive approach, prevent them from trying to get their hands on some of those documents.
Part of this came out of Michael Cohen's testimony, right? The president's former personal lawyer, when he was before the House, I think it was, he was saying, yeah, the president and his business would give one number to a bank, a different number to the IRS, maybe a different number to an insurance company. Nobody wants to do anything based solely on Michael Cohen saying a thing, but this is something that they could actually check out and confirm if they got hold of these records. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it would be fairly easy to match up. Now, they are in a separate committee and separate investigation are trying to get their hands on President Trump's tax returns, which the president and, in fact, the IRS is resisting at the moment. The president, as we know, has refused ever since he was a candidate to release his tax returns, while other presidential candidates in 2016 and in this 2020 field have already done so. And so I think, you know, the Democrats have a point. They're asking, what is the president hiding by not releasing his tax returns? What is he hiding in not releasing some of these bank statements? And is he potentially trying to cover up some kind of crime?
Are there other developments in standoffs between Democrats in the House and the president? They're asking for a lot of people to testify, for example. They're looking for various records. What are we seeing in the relationship between House Democrats and the White House on these issues?
I mean, the posture of the president and the White House has been very clear. They have warned people not to cooperate with these House Democrats. House Democrats have issued a number of subpoenas, including to, the former White House counsel, Don McGahn, who did, in fact, cooperate with the Bob Mueller investigation. And so, the two sides, Democrats and the president and the White House, have really taken sort of a warlike posture. They're really digging in for what's going to be a long battle. And, in more recent days, we have heard Democrats say, well, we are prepared now, if people are resisting our subpoenas, refusing to testify, refusing to hand over documents, we are prepared to fine them. We have the power to fine individuals, and we also have the power to put people in prison, which seems like a pretty extreme case. We haven't quite gotten there, but this is sort of the rhetoric that is being discussed right now in this fight.
And finally, Scott, we had two likely nominees for the Federal Reserve Board coming from the president. The names Herman Cain and Stephen Moore had been floated. Herman Cain, he's out. He's not going to be it. Now, another nominee, conservative pundit Stephen Moore, is getting maybe not rave reviews from Republican senators who would be key to confirming him. What kind of things are you hearing?
Right. Now, in recent weeks, we have seen a number of writings and TV commentary unearthed involving Stephen Moore. He has often been a pundit on TV, somebody who talks about economic issues and things. But he has said things like, sexist things like women athletes should not be able to demand equal pay for inferior work, or things like female athletes have no business participating in March Madness, the basketball tournament. That has infuriated a number of Republican senators, including some of the female Republican senators like Joni Ernst of Iowa and Susan Collins of Maine. And so, a lot of these folks have serious reservations about whether Stephen Moore should, in fact, be formally nominated and confirmed by the Senate for this top position, and are raising objections. And so, I think it depends on whether the president wants to expend some political capital to really try to push him through, or if right now, as it looks like, if these four women do band together, they do have the power to basically kill off the nomination before Trump issues a formal nomination for Stephen Moore.
Did I also see that Stephen Moore had referred to Cincinnati as an armpit, which raised the hackles of an Ohio Republican senator who's from, as I understand it, Cincinnati?
I missed that comment. I'm sure, as the days drag on, people are pouring through his writings and all of his various TV appearances. And so I missed that particular comment, but I would not be surprised that the particular senator from Cincinnati might be peeved by that comment.
And briefly, Scott, as we wrap up, what are you watching for in the next week? What's the big story you're waiting for to break?
Well, I think we probably have enough presidential candidates jumping into 2020, although there seem to be more every day. One story we're watching right now is the fact that a lot of top Democratic potential candidates for the Senate seem to be taking a pass. Just a few moments ago, one of the Castro brothers who served in the House decided to pass on a Senate bid in Texas. That was a little bit of a surprise. And so Chuck Schumer is having a real struggle in trying to recruit top-notch candidates that will be needed in order for Democrats to take back the Senate in 2020.
Stacey Abrams in Georgia, too, saying she's not running.
That's
Is that right?
That's right.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks so much.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He was with us for a weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics. Still time to share your thoughts on some of the issues we've been talking about, including the issue of infrastructure. Do you think this tentative agreement between the president and Democratic congressional leaders is going to lead to an actual plan? Do you want to see a big investment in the roads of the United States, making new ones, fixing old ones, bridges, rail, ports, things like that? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's road construction season in Wisconsin, speaking of infrastructure, and that means winter potholes will be filled up throughout the summer. One of our neighbors to the south took a unique approach and filled potholes with food. A Chicago TV host filmed a segment where he filled potholes with jardiniera, a relish of pickled vegetables and vinegar or oil that people use on hot dogs. Judith Sears Poisson is in the studio with me. You have the supply in your office.
I always have jardiniera on hand. I am a Chicago girl at heart. Actually, it's even better on Italian beef sandwiches. But
That's right. That's what people do with it.
But yeah, my first response was, what a waste of good jardiniera. But yeah.
And that raised the other question of, is there a Wisconsin-themed food that we think would make a good, pothole filler?
Well, I don't think cheese curds, because the squeaking would drive everyone crazy.
Right. Yeah, you wouldn't want to be in the house with the squeak, squeak, squeak every time a car rolled over.
No. But I did have an idea that is not necessarily Wisconsin, but many, many, many years ago, I worked in a restaurant that served hush puppies, a little deep fried southern kind of cornmeal and onion things. And when it was slow, we would put one in a glass of water and see how long it took to soak up all the water. And it was pretty much instantaneous.
Wow.
So I'm going with hush puppies for construction season.
All right. And if anybody at the Department of Transportation is listening, stock up on hush puppies for the rapid replacement of potholes. Thanks, Judith.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.